You're listening to Not Many of You Should Become Teachers, a podcast that explores the world of K-12 education as it intersects with the Christian faith. You might call us extreme moderates. We're skeptics who try not to be cynics and are allergic to cheap rhetoric. Welcome to the show.
And here we are, friends. All of you who are our friends out there in podcast land, tuning in for another episode of Not Many of You Should Become Teachers. And why is that, you might ask? And we would send you to the book of James, where it says, "For we know that those who teach will be judged more strictly." Which is a high calling and certainly a profession and a role in life that we want to take very seriously. But we have a lot of fun as we do it. We know it's a high calling. We know it's a lot of responsibility, but it's massively transformational. And grateful that we have people who, like you, are listening in. Doing a solo episode this week, and thought I would talk a little bit about a turnaround time, which is end of semester for me in the high school, and also dive in a little bit to The Grand Paradox, which is our ongoing book club, book study. I hope you have been tuning into the segments in the previous episodes. Riley did a bunch of them. I did a chapter last time. We skipped a couple episodes on that, and we are now in chapter 7. So we'll talk a little bit about doubt and just a few thoughts that have bubbled up from reading that chapter and also just encounters in the classroom. So buckle up, here we go. It is the end of semester 1 in the high school where I teach. And that means the week ahead is, when you're listening to this, will be a bit of a transition week. As we wind down, we have a couple days to conclude classes. We have what are called assessment days, which of course are exams or things in lieu of exams and final summative tasks and all of that. And then we have a little turnaround day and get our headspace into semester 2. It's kind of nice getting to start again mid-year. One of the perks of that is to start fresh. But it's a little hard to think that far afield when we're trying to wrap things up and finish well. So there's both of those things at play. A few things that I've observed in the end of semester 1 and finishing classes is you don't always get to end on your own terms. And for any of you who live in the Pacific Northwest, you know that we got pounded with some snow. Actually, the word is walloped. I read that on CBC News. It said we were getting walloped. And we got walloped, and the school we teach at shut down for a couple of days. Even the public schools in and around the Lower Mainland of British Columbia were also closed midweek. And so that throws a little wrench into your timetable and how you plan to do things. Now, for some of us, let's be real, it might mean that the lesson plans that we had, actually, the timing's actually better because we might be trying to squeeze a few things into a week. I know that bringing things in for a landing, I've got some summative stuff, some term papers that students are doing. And I was able to sit at home and drink hot chocolate and go sledding with my son and then reply to a few emails. So it was kind of a nice change of pace, but we didn't get to decide that. There's always interruptions and anticipation. I've got in IB, for example, the International Baccalaureate Program, students are doing what are called mock exams next week. So really leading up into that, you have to sort of hit pause on some of the content and what you're doing and start into structure and some review and that type of thing. So it's just a different change of pace, and relationship with the students, of course, are really important as we navigate this together. Coming to the end of a course gives us pause on what we've accomplished, looking back through our goals for the course, the relationships that we built with students. And so for those of us who are on a semestered basis, saying goodbye to students and having a definitive conclusion, even though it's mid-school year, gives an opportunity for for reflection on our practice and to recognize how we relate to students, what it might mean in the realm of faith formation, largely in the realm of relationship. Certainly we can, you know, talk about what it means for us to think biblically or to think in terms of Christian faith formation via our courses, whatever that might be, and the topics, the content matter, and our actual pedagogy, but the Christian spaces that we have cultivated for a number of weeks with our students, and when that is coming to an end, it allows for us to reflect. Part of that reflection can also come from students themselves. I've moved massively towards less formal student evaluations, and I'm grateful in the context of the school I teach at, we have some latitude on how we solicit feedback from our students. There's not a school-wide form or anything like that, but we are expected to solicit that feedback, to hear from students, to better hone our own practice. And one of the things that I do, just thinking about the nature of our podcast and the conversations we've had about faith and learning, is to think, how has this been a discipling moment in the life of this young person? Even if my content matter, I don't see it as naturally overlapping with even the theme your school might have for a year, or personal-led devotional thoughts, or the opportunities you've had to pray for students, etc. But really thinking about the foundation of the relationship that we have with our students. And so I do that. I offer an opportunity for written feedback. I would love to hear from students. A lot of it's a little bit more informal, and then I'll draft up, what am I taking away? I'll sort of write down, what am I taking away from that course? When I taught, you know, Social Studies 11, what was it in my semester one Social Studies 11? One of the tools I have that we use is Google Classroom. So you know, when that stuff goes on the cloud, it never goes away. But I do archive my classes, and not only do I go back and look at and access content and sort of harvest from that and use it in the next batch of students that I have, but it allows me to write a little bit of a reflective piece right at the end. I don't post it for students to see, although now even as I'm speaking that sounds like something that would be awesome to do, is sort of to hear Mr. McFarland's sort of post-mortem on the course and the climate, and just even have that in writing. That's kind of cool. So I might do that. And then I have access to that, and I can trace along. So be interesting to hear from some of you educators out there, if there's any practices that you do in terms of reflection and how that and sort of course evaluation, and how that might fit with faith formation and our reflection on being effective and more faithful Christian teachers. One final note I'll add on that is around age appropriate or divisional level appropriateness for how we would do course evaluations and feedback. So for those of you who are in some of the younger grades in the K-12 world, what does that look like? It'd be interesting to hear and hear back from you, and also to think through, what does that mean? Also an age-appropriate level faith formation, and how that information might get to you. All right, and now the grand paradox, the book that we have been slowly reading through. A reminder to our listeners, if you're just tuning in and have not been following, this was actually the book that we gave to our graduating class. Each grad received a copy of this. It is a relatively new book by an author named Ken Weitzma, who also lives in the Pacific Northwest down in Oregon. And this book is The Grand Paradox, The Messiness of Life, The Mystery of God, and The Necessity of Faith. As you might expect in a book about the necessity of faith and the paradox of life, doubt is going to be a theme that would be worthy of an entire chapter, and sure enough, it's there. And so we're going to dive in just a little bit. Weitzma starts the chapter with a quote from Khalil Gibran, and I'm probably butchering that name, but Khalil says this: "Doubt is a pain too lonely to know that faith is his twin brother." It's a pain that's too lonely to know that faith is its twin brother. These things are linked. One of the things that I really appreciated that Weitzma does in this text is talk about different kinds of doubt. And one of the kinds of doubt, he has this category. He calls it, there's honest doubt, legitimate, sincere, honest doubt, and what he calls stupid doubt. And stupid doubt is doubt that is trendy. It's stylish. It can be hip and cool to be a skeptic. And one of the things that we've talked so much on this podcast has become a little bit of a tagline for Riley and I is that we want to be skeptical. We don't want to be cynical. But I think an author like Ken Weitzman is going to push us, even us, on that a little bit and say, you know, that there, it can be trendy or hip. That's actually that's kind of our angle. That's kind of the whole rationale for this podcast, is that there can be a skeptical, dare we even say, room for doubt, and a doubting faith or a skeptical faith that doesn't take things on at face value, that is also enmeshed in faith. But Weitzma would push us to say, are we doing that just because that is a cultural posture or that's a societal norm for us? And so I'm reading from page 65. This is what Ken Weitzma says. He says, in Western culture, it's trendy to doubt and be skeptical. In fact, people who claim certainty or truth are viewed as extremists. And I think this idea of certainty and certitude being viewed as extreme is also viewed as people who are sincere. So if you sincerely hold to things, that is also a posture or a position that can be mocked. And we live in a deeply cynical time. We live in a time that is massively ironic. And to be edgy is to always tell things with a slant. And anybody who is trying to tell something straight or trying to be honest and maybe even innocent and sincere about something doesn't even have to be religious faith. It could be just life, is seen as maybe naive or a simpleton, that type of thing. So this idea that doubt is cool or that we should doubt is not exactly the type of doubting posture that Weitzma would have us take. And of course, this moves us into what does it mean to have honest doubt, to have real doubt, and not to push that away. Because the flip side of that, of course, is that Christianity, religious systems, faith itself can be seen as maybe a crutch or something that is for people who are weak or who need to see the world through rose-colored glasses, people who cannot handle the truth, that type of thing, which is kind of ironic. The truth that the world is not as we might think it would be, or as simple as we might think it would be. And friends, I must admit, it's a little closer to home than even the podcast. This sometimes can be my MO or my posture or, dare I say, my shtick as a teacher, to be completely transparent here, is my level of, quote, edginess, which, again, I'm not really that edgy of a person, but my angle in, or I've been able to get some traction with students because I show my hand a little bit. I let them know that I share some of their skepticism, which I think is good, and I think that's a positive thing. I just need to check myself that is this just the trendy or the simple thing that I'm doing, as opposed to with a very clear purpose of what do I sincerely believe, what do I hold on to? I know we've mentioned it before on this podcast, but the work and the thinking of pastor and writer Jonathan Martin is coming to mind when I think about this. When he talks about deconstruction, using the language of our time, a lot of people deconstructing their faith, a lot of people who maybe graduate from institutions like ours who are handed books like The Graham Paradox and then likely don't read it, who start to deconstruct And it's fun. It can be fun to deconstruct and it can be fun to tear down, but what are we building? And we have to be constructing something as well. And the demolition part of a construction project sometimes can be the most exciting. And there's a painstaking work to be done as well. So it's just it's actually a cautionary note on doubt. The next thing that Weitzman does is he talks through some of the, I was about to say the predictable, but that almost sounds negative. The places we would expect him to go, and that of course is the classic story of Job in the Old Testament, the Psalms of Lament, and the whole wide range of human emotion that is expressed in the book of Psalms. So much of it that is crying out for, where is God? God appears absent. There are no answers to things. I didn't even mention the book of Ecclesiastes. And so the wisdom tradition is there, and it's for us. And so he does that, and he cites a number of different psalms that maybe we wouldn't expect to show up necessarily on a Sunday morning or in a Bible class lesson. Certainly wouldn't be, you know, shared, tweeted out, or shared on Instagram or whatever, and goes there. And talks, of course, about how answers don't always help, right? So sometimes giving an answer in sort of an apologetic form of, I can give you the answer to this, is actually short-circuiting the work that uncertainty and openness to the mystery of God may be needing to work in our lives and in our hearts. And he goes on from there. Now, I'd like to do a reading of a segment that Weitzma has in his chapter on doubt, which is actually something that is unexpected. It's something that I didn't anticipate. I've had these types of thoughts. I've even constructed lessons in history class and historical thinking around the act of remembrance and around the idea of recalling, both in a community context and to ourselves, recalling the works of God, remembering what he's done in the past. And so that's kind of in my wheelhouse a little bit. And I want to read this because he is explaining it or couching it within this chapter of wrestling with the mystery of God, God who's there, the God who we don't want trite or simple answers, and that we can't just plug and play answers. And the subsection is called Choosing Reality. So let me read this section on Choosing Reality. For those of you following along, I'm on page 77. He says this: "We need to learn to discipline ourselves to keep moving when we begin to be hung up by our doubts. Seeking healthy community is one way we do that." Oh, time out. I got to pause for a second. The community aspect of find a community, get in a healthy community, get in right relationships, this can almost be off-putting, I think, for some who it might even be seen as a trite answer, even though we know it is like a right and true answer that you need to be in a good, healthy community. I love what Weitzman does. He says, that's one of them. And then he goes here. Let me resume. Page 77. Seeking a healthy community is one way we do that. Another habit that can be helpful is the discipline of remembrance. When we see an example of this, we see an example of this in the story of Joshua. After the Israelites crossed the Jordan River, God instructed them to raise a memorial to remind them that God had delivered them. "Let this be a sign among you, so that when your children ask later, saying, 'What do these stones mean to you?' then you shall say to them, 'Because the waters of the Jordan were cut off before the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, when it crossed the Jordan, the waters of the Jordan were cut off.'" That's from the book of Joshua, chapter 4. Remembering the goodness of God can be difficult in the midst of challenging circumstances. Think back to the last time you were sick for longer than 5 days. When you've been sick for a week or more, it becomes difficult to remember what it feels like to be well. Sickness becomes your reality. Sort of like this cough that I've been having for the last 2 weeks. In a similar way, Weitzman continues, doubt, pain, and frustration can easily become our reality. In the midst of losing a house, it can be difficult to remember all the cherished memories you have been blessed with there. In fact, your cherished memories might even contribute to your pain. because you realize that that part of your life is ending. The old phrase, count your blessings, might be trite, but it is apt. The discipline of remembrance is synonymous with the discipline of praise. I'm not saying that we should praise God inauthentically by praying prayers we don't mean or singing songs that we cannot feel. But there is something powerful about disciplining ourselves to remember God's blessings and reminding ourselves of times when we felt His presence and His goodness. That is a passage and a story that I tell about God's people when they're crossing the Jordan River, and some of the very first things that happens, one of the very first instructions that God gives to His people is what I call a history lesson, right? It's a social studies lesson, is to build monuments and memorials and commemoration and having an answer. And there's a pedagogy that is happening of teaching your children when they ask questions of why are things the way that they are. And so this act of remembrance, I think, is an important one. And it plays a role for us as teachers. I don't just mean social studies and history teachers, although that's certainly going to be central to what I do. But I think for us to recall or allow students to remember in the context of their own lives, to give space for them to remember that in the context of their own schooling. I'm saying this sort of on the fly, even as I'm just recording this, that sometimes I am guilty of talking about the differences, or by that I mean, I will say to a student in, say, grade 10 or 11, if they're in a Bible class with me, I will go to great lengths to point out how their faith should be different from a grade 2 or grade 3 class, or their grade 5 Bible class, or Mr. Dueck's grade 6 Bible class, and that they're a different person when they're in high school, and that they'll be a different person a decade later. So I highlight the differences. But maybe I should have a bit of a corrective and a little bit of a balance there of allowing students to remember the good. This goes back again to my default mode of being somewhat skeptical, and I've gotten a lot of traction with students on that. But one of the things that I am working on, and because I don't have all the answers to this, is for me to affirm and to acknowledge the goodness of the journey that they've been on and where have they seen God present in their lives. That is actually, to use my phrase from before, a little bit more painstaking, I think. I think it's more problematic or challenging for us because we have been groomed in Christian subculture for talking about blessing and talking about goodness of God. It moves very quickly into the language that of the trite. It moves into surface level, and it can become, for lack of a better phrase, just plain cheesy. And back to, again, to what Weitzman was pointing out, skeptical is the default or the norm or hip and cool. And so to have all these things working together, to have all of these things interconnected and playing with one another is constantly happening in our classrooms and in our spaces. So friends, as you go into a new week. Most of you are probably listening to this early on in a week. If you're starting a new semester, if you're winding one down, if you don't even know what a semester is, and you are just chugging along, and you're in the middle of January, and September is a long time ago, and June, you can't even begin to fathom June or what is beyond, be encouraged. And lean into, to use Weitzman's phrase, this grand paradox, this language of faith as necessity, that we need this. We so desperately need it. So thank you again for listening to this episode. And there's more that could be said. It's probably good to wrap it up there. The next section that we'll be looking at is chapter 8, which is on personal calling and mission. Again, calling, vocation, mission, these things can have a triteness to them. I think Weitzman offers us something quite profound, and we'll unpack that together. So I mentioned a couple of times that it would be great to hear some feedback from some of you. And if you'd like to get in touch with us, we are active on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is @notmanyofyou. You can go to www.notmanyofyou.com. and find all of our previous episodes. You can find our contact information, notmanyofyou@gmail.com. there are ways that you can get in touch with us. And we would love to resurrect the mailbag or the digital mailbag and hear from some of you and some feedback. Maybe on our podcast in general, or on this episode in particular, maybe on Weitzman's book. If you're following along The Grand Paradox, certainly would love to hear from you, or some of those questions that I posed in the episode. That's all from me. Thank you so much for listening in, and we'll be back with more of Not Many of You Should Become Teachers in the near future.